speaking to people from other traditions can help us to be more aware of the reality of the gift that we already possess as Christians, the reality of Christ in our midst. By having that gift, we're able to affirm and see how that's working in people who may explicitly or not explicitly talk about Jesus. For us as Christians, that should get us excited because we can see the power of God working in ways that kind of go outside the parameters or our definitions.
Welcome back to Religion to Reality, the podcast about living an integrated life. I'm your host, Dave Plisky.
And I'm Father John Grabowicz.
This season has been all about listening. In our first season of Religion to Reality, the podcast, we heard from a number of different Christians, mostly Catholics, some Protestants. We were unpacking this study on discipleship that we did. And over, the thing that we heard was how sacred listening is. And that was unprompted from our guests. And so we said, okay, if this is what we're hearing, how can we be better listeners? And what can we do as Catholics to be great listeners? And so we said, okay, well, maybe the thing to do is to listen to voices from across the spectrum of traditions. And that's what we did. That's what this season has been all about. And so if you are listening to this right now, this is the final episode of Religion to Reality. We had planned to do 10 episodes this season, ended up doing 26 across, I think, 29 guests, or actually 30 guests. There's 30 guests. And yeah, I guess I would just say, like, up front, if you've stumbled onto this podcast and decided to listen to the last episode first, because I know that's a thing, I would just not do that with this episode, with this podcast. This is not a good place to start. This is a good place to end. I would start at the beginning of season two if I was you. It's a pretty satisfying arc, I think. And you know, we kind of take you through. But anyway, yeah. So this is what we want to do with this episode. It's just me and John. John, I just want to talk to you about kind of everything we learned, just kind of our takeaways and what it meant for us to be with all of these guests from all these walks of life. It was pretty amazing, actually, for me. And, you know, obviously we could never do a completely thorough job, but we did speak to people from the most popular religions and faith traditions around the world, which I'm pretty pleased with.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing, the amount of guests that we were able to book for this. And, you know, even if we're not kind of giving a representation of like every religion, I think it's more about just the encounters with each person. I mean, and just really where they are. I mean, I don't think that any of these people who we interviewed were necessarily being like the representative of the religion that they felt a part of. I think that it was just more about them as individuals than anything else.
100%. That's right. And they're, you know, they're not delegates for this religion or something. They're just a person right. Who is interested in interreligious dialogue, right?
Absolutely.
And so we were there for the moment, you know. I do want to kind of just give a shout out of a few, like kind of the season by the numbers, if you will. So we spoke with people from 9 faith traditions, and that includes 2 Muslims, 3 Jews, a Hindu, 6 Buddhists, 2 Taoists, a Confucian, a Sikh, 2 Shinto, and within Christianity, an Orthodox, 4 Protestants and 7 Catholics. It's pretty interesting. And a partridge in a pear tree, of course. 2 of them, interestingly, advised President Obama while he was in administration in the White House. At least 4 don't belong to just one tradition. 5 are current or former monks or nuns across 3 different faiths. 5 are university professors. 6 hold ordained titles. That includes rabbi, minister, priest, shifu, guji. 1 is a Princeton wrestling champion who wandered into a Buddhist center after a vision of Christ in an English country church. One is a singer-songwriter who discovered... you have something to say about that?
Who was that?
That was Kitisaro.
Oh, yes.
Weinberg.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. My gosh, heck, I forget. Yeah.
Yeah. 1 is a singer-songwriter who discovered an 1800-year-old problem of the Gospel of John and is now changing the footnotes of the Greek critical text that every modern Bible is translated from. And of course, that was Elizabeth Poulter.
Yeah, she was great.
Yeah. I almost said Libby. I call her by her nickname. 1 had her first meaningful meditation experience during a Catholic mass. 1 prayed the rosary for weeks during a year-long silent retreat in a Buddhist forest monastery. 1 is a Benedictine monk who performs Quranic verses in Arabic for Muslim audiences. We had people from Africa, Asia, Europe, the Middle East, North America. It was pretty awesome, I would say.
I mean, just you kind of rattling off those stats, my gosh, made me think that we were really part of something special. I mean, how could this have ever come together unless it was just meant to be? So it's just really great to use this opportunity to reverence what we were able to be a part of. And I mean that.
Absolutely. You know, there are a ton of religions that we weren't able to include. Like this, obviously, the season would just go on forever if we were to try to include all of the world religions. But, you know, we got the biggest ones, meaning the ones with the largest populations. And I think that's significant. There are a few that we did try to get that I wasn't able to connect with anyone who practices. Mm-hmm. And those include some of the African traditions, some of the indigenous American traditions. We did a really good job. I think it was thorough enough.
Absolutely.
We even had an atheist, and a couple of people asked me, like, are you gonna have people with from no faith tradition? And the plan was no, because I, you know, we're talking about practices, and if you define yourself by what you don't believe, then it's like, all right, well, you're essentially saying, like, I don't have a tradition that gives me ritual or practice to draw from. And so that was not really kind of the scope of the project. But one of the people who is inside a faith tradition is an atheist that we talked to. And so I just want to talk about, like, what religion means, John, for a minute.
Sure.
You know, speaking to all these people, I think I would have told you growing up that religion is basically philosophy that involves God.
Mm.
And I don't think that that's a good definition anymore, because there are a lot of religions that don't involve God or gods. And there are religions that are also cultures or ethnicities. And that practicing a religion that does involve God doesn't necessarily involve God in the practice. So, sure. So I think that was a very limited, it's a very Christian kind of way to look at the world. And speaking of that, you know, I told you, like, one of the things that's been really just remarkable to me is just how much we seem to want to label things and put things in categories. You know, I told you one of the reasons that I didn't name the episodes after the faith traditions that the person is from is because it's a little reductive. And again, we said they're not representing their tradition necessarily, but more than that, it creates kind of like a boundary that I don't think a person needs to necessarily hold. And I guess I was inspired by, during the recording of this season, I was reading the book Dominion by Tom Holland, and he pointed out that the people of India did not consider themselves Hindu. And we talked a little bit about this with Anju Bhargava. You know, the reality is this was a term that these colonists essentially foisted upon them, because it's like, oh, non-Christians, what, we got to call you something. And suddenly all of these very, very diverse kind of beliefs and practices and traditions from across India were just all kind of put under this tent called Hindu. Meanwhile, like, these people would not have really considered themselves their so-called religious practices as really separate from the rest of their lives. And that's, I think, like, when I think about living an integrated life, that's it, right? Like, you're not labeling, you're not saying, oh, I'm doing my Christian thing now, and I'm doing my, you know what I mean? Like, imagine if breathing was I don't even want to say sacred, because it's like delineating more, but mm-hmm. breathing was at the level of going to church when you think about, you know, your practice. That's, I think, what that did for me. And I felt so grateful to just talk to people who seem to live pretty integrated lives like this, and not, sure. maybe not thinking so much about the faith tradition that they're espousing.
Yeah, there's something about the practices or even the rituals that people espoused to be something to just being at the core of who they are as a human being. So I feel like we kind of interviewed a lot of people who felt more human than, say, religious in a certain way. And that what we determine or what we've now classified as religion is how they are able to function as a human in the world, because it's just what brings them life, you know? So it's like you were saying about breath. I mean, that's a good just example. It's just like breathing should be is so much caught up in the very action of prayer than if we were on our knees in a chapel praying. That, you know, that's how prayer is, you know, that we hear from even St. Paul to pray ceasingly, and that there's always a confusion there, thinking like, well, were we supposed to just not work or do anything? We're just supposed to be on our knees or in a chapel or something like that, a church. But, you know, when you're able to fully embrace your humanity, in a certain sense, you're now actually fully engaged with your relationship with God, because you're so aware of yourself in relationship to the one who is allowing you to be, you know? I mean, and maybe that's, maybe we understand that as a very personal thing, maybe as a Christian, and of course, other faith traditions look at God as being personal too. But I think there's something about always being aware that you are a participant in something bigger than yourself. And I think that's what all of these different guests were able to kind of touch upon in a different way, that, you know, life is about participation, not orchestration. And I think that that is really what came to the forefront of how people used the practices that were introduced to them through the tradition that they espouse, and were able to really understand who they were in light of the rest of the cosmos, really, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, that's right. I certainly grew in my kind of just ability to speak in an inclusive way, I think, when it comes mm-hmm. to, you know, speaking to people from other faith traditions. You know, for example, saying the divine instead of God, or sacred texts instead of scriptures, just to make it a little bit more inclusive. But then something that surprised me was just the fact that, at least in English, we use the terms like clergy and liturgy kind of across the board. You know, anyone who's ordained is clergy, which I sort of associated with Christian tradition. So I don't know. That was interesting to me. One of the things that's always tricky when we're interviewing people is that, you know, we're trying not to talk to each other, right? We're trying to talk to our guest. And so, you know, there's sometimes where one of us would make a really interesting comment, and out of deference to the guest, the other host is not the one to respond. The guest is, right? But there's times where, like, you know, we said some interesting things, I thought, and I was like kind of wanting to get your opinion about it, but unfortunately we just, you know, it was the time for the guest to talk. So now that I have you here, I wanted to one of the things that I mentioned, I think it was in the Eva Netanya episode, mm-hmm. I was talking about how Richard Rohr has this idea that, like, maybe the church is essentially, like, if you think of the church as a person, it's only as old, it grows a year for every century since Jesus. And so the church is essentially like just legal. Like, remember we talked about, like, we're finally 21, you know, That's not a novel idea. What I was saying was, is it possible that, like, the church itself needs to move towards the second half of life, and we're only halfway there. Like, we're so young still. And that like it, you know, I really believe in what we're doing on this podcast. And I just wonder, is this a movement towards, is this something that we can say could never have happened? I mean, okay. So Nostra Aetate, right? In Vatican II, finally acknowledging the truths of other religions. I think it was Brad Molkowski who was talking about, like, this document was originally meant to be kind of a response to the many years of poor relations between Jews and Christians because of the church's stance on certain things. And it ended up being inclusive of, you know, and specifically calling out Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, et cetera. And anyway, I just wonder if you think that interreligious dialogue is one of the components of the church maturing into its second, toward its second half of life eventually, if we can say that.
Well, I guess the short answer is yes. I mean, I'm thinking a little bit more about that second half of life reference. I mean, I think the church has always had opportunities to kind of move into a deeper awareness of what it means to be incarnational in the world. And I think that that happens in moments of crisis. I think of lots of the saints that really they were responding to crisis moments happening in the church where they felt as somehow the institution was not representing at the fullness what an incarnational spirituality could be, like not fully being aware and alive to the reality of Christ's presence in our midst and becoming, as it's often thought, to be too worldly. But that just simply means somehow thinking that we as people are kind of the orchestrators rather than the participants. So I think that there's been these moments, you just think of some of the more famous saints like Saint Francis of Assisi, rebuild my church, which is so much in ruin. I think his way of going about that and bringing about, a mendicant order, the Franciscans, that was really just leaning into the graciousness of God's presence in all things, and that's how they were going to be able to navigate through the world without really worrying about themselves necessarily being making sure that they had this the comfort and security that they need to function in society. Like that's a very second half of life moment right there. I mean, because it's pure vulnerability at that point. So I think, you look at the modern context, what is the crisis today? I mean, we still have to kind of really reckon with the fact that the church is really gone through a real horrible patch with like the sexual abuse scandal and just other types of ways of that the church doesn't seem to be relevant to maybe the signs of the times, which is really what the Vatican Council was calling us to be attentive to. And there seems to be maybe the sense that the church can weather our time by just being this bulwark of truth and tradition that's unchangeable. But I don't know if that's really the full answer. Somehow, I think that there needs to be a way to recognize that a deepening awareness of what it means to be an incarnational people, a sacramental people, goes beyond what we've already kind of defined. It has to go even deeper. It's not about changing things, it's about going deeper in things. And I think that speaking to people from other traditions can help us to be more aware of the reality of the gift that we already possess as Christians, the reality of Christ in our midst, because we can be able to, by having that gift, we're able to affirm and see how that's working in people who may explicitly or not explicitly talk about Jesus. And for us as Christians, that should get us excited because we can see the power of God working in ways that kind of go outside the parameters or our definitions. And I don't think that's a threat. That's a deepening. So this could be a second half moment, a second half of life moment right now for the church to once again enter into that place of vulnerability, humility, to recognize that the Spirit is still speaking to the world. And maybe the Spirit's speaking in ways that we are not used to or maybe uncomfortable with, but are nevertheless true.
What does it look like to be Christians who recognize the sacramentality and the incarnationality of the world in a deeper way, as you're talking about? I mean, obviously beyond, what we're saying here about interreligious dialogue, what are some of these other deepenings that we like, what can people do now to start living?
Well, I think it comes from the fundamental awareness that Christ is either everything or nothing in that sense. We understand Christ as Jesus, as the one who comes into the world, who reveals the depth of God's love, that shows to us that we are in communion with God in and through Jesus, so that we are all beloved sons and daughters, as Jesus is the beloved Son of God. So we share that same dynamic with God. So I think, by understanding that relationship that we have with God in and through his son Jesus, I think that enlightens us to the awareness that, everyone is participating in that same type of relationship, whether they know it or not. Like they just are. Now, I don't think that people necessarily have to know it the way that Christians know it, because I think it just kind of transcends knowledge. Because as you were getting to your first point, it's just what it means to be human, that we live in a way that is in relationship with each other and with the source of relationships, which, of course, as Christians, we would say the Trinity. But like, I think that that to me is just so foundational here to be aware of, that you can't get away from what we as Catholics and Christians call Jesus just simply because you're with people who aren't explicitly Christian. You can't get away, because either Christ, the Word made flesh, is animating everything, or he's not, right? And it's impossible to think of God's love outside of something just simply because someone hasn't affirmed it or hasn't somehow recognized it in their own way. And I think that this is really getting, this should really break open the whole idea that, you know, certain people have it right and other people are wrong. I think in this sense, if you're human, we all have it right in the sense that we are participants. How much we acknowledge what is really kind of the question. And for each person, I think it varies on how much they need to even acknowledge at some points, because everyone's on a different place on the journey, the spiritual journey of unpacking things. Like, you know, for those of us who have been gifted with, say, the gift of Catholicism, that's a real gift, and we have to take that seriously. And, you know, the way things have been articulated and defined in 2,000 years of church history provides a very helpful way of engaging the world. Yet, is it absolutely necessary to have all that in order to be able to be a participant in an incarnational worldview? I just don't think it is. I don't think that God, in his love, would make it so conditional on how well each person accepts the articulation of things. And once again, that's not about kind of somehow saying it's not important.
Right.
It's just kind of affirming that each person is already participating in the life of Christ,
right.
Which,
but the articulation can you know, be the thing that helps you kind of form the mindset that gets you to go deeper as you encounter
absolutely.
A different, you know, each different person or
absolutely
whatever it
absolutely
might be.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about some of the threads that ran through the whole season. Certain names kept coming up. You know, the ones that I was picking up on: Thomas Merton, Thich Nhat Hanh, and Bede Griffiths. At mm-hmm. least two or three guests mentioned each of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably the thing that the theme that ties those three people together is their interest in interreligious dialogue, right?
So,
Thomas Merton spent the last part of his life, you know, I mean, he literally ended up dying in Asia on a trip doing, you know, Buddhism in dialogue, right? Thich Nhat Hanh has written a couple books about the intersection of Christianity and Buddhism. Bede Griffiths, go ahead.
Merton was actually at an interreligious monastic conference when he died, so it was from different traditions. It wasn't
okay,
just Buddhism.
Oh, yeah. Cool. That's great. And similarly with Bede Griffiths, right? Just all about interreligious dialogue and kind of, I mean, it was 20th century, but it felt early, right? I guess in the timeline. I also noticed, you know, a number of our guests have lived or even were still living in monastic settings, either connected to those communities, spent time as sisters, brothers, monks, nuns. You know, it was Brian Lorenz who mentioned, you know, you don't have to go away somewhere to find God. In fact, if you do that, you're trying to do a little bit of a scam. I think his dad was telling him this when he was trying to figure out like how to connect with God, and he was trying to figure out a trip to Asia, I think, to to start making this real for him. But I feel like we have to hold both, right? The fact that God is not elsewhere. We don't, and in fact, finding God in the mundane is maybe one of the most important things we can do, because that's the day in, day out of life, right? That's the breath, even if you want. But at the same time, there seems to be something happens in the silence and solitude, right? That is a meaningful thing, even if you don't need to get into that to find God. But contemplation takes us one level deeper, as long as we're not only staying there in contemplation, right? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think contemplation can be something you're doing all the time anyway. So, I mean, I think that the way that it's described in I don't know if you would call it secular traditions. I don't know if that's the right way of saying it, but is open awareness, that you're just aware of your surroundings. You're aware of where you are, where you're going, what may help you get there, what may not. I mean, there's just an awareness. And I think that's what contemplation ultimately is. I mean, the point of like sitting and meditating is just to try to train yourself to be that way in everything you do. You know, I think that that's, I think to be a walking contemplative is sometimes, as I think, is something that I've said maybe before, is the goal. So yeah, you want to be contemplating all the time.
The Jesus prayer came up in three of our interviews with Frederica Matthews Green, with Brad Malkowski, and with Kyra Jewelingo, talking mm-hmm. about her husband Adam's practice. Another theme that came up over and over was purification, how the importance of, you know, purifying. You know, we heard in Taoist and Shinto conversations, we were hearing a lot about that. But then, you know, I know in our minds that sometimes out loud, we're tying it back to, you know, the priest washes his hands before the Eucharistic meal, right? For a reason. Like there's, in, you know, baptism, all these purification rituals.
Well, even the purification of the chalice at the mass, that's a kind of a big moment yeah. where that comes into play too.
Yeah. So it seems like healthy world religions recognize the fallen nature of the world, I guess, if you want to call it, speak about it in Christian terms, even if that's not, you know, and the importance of cleanliness or maybe the, you know, and it, you know, it's, and this is not, I'm not trying to make a surface statement. Nowhere in the Bible does it say cleanliness is next to godliness, right? That's not a, that's like a folk idea, I guess, more than anything. Mm-hmm. You recognize, like, I think maybe it's out of respect for just the awe that we should have before God. It's like we're never really going to be at the level, you know. And mm-hmm. so whatever we can do, whatever little thing we can do to kind of show that we would like to be, you know, it's kind of like in the Merton prayer, right? When he talks about like, I don't know, I'm going to get the wording wrong, but he's like, you know, I don't know that this is the right path, but I think that by doing this, you will accept that I'm butchering it.
Hold it's on, all about having the desire. My desire is enough.
Exactly. Yeah. Another theme through a few of these is major illness. And that's not surprising to me because we know that, you know, major catastrophes in life are often where people kind of make their big spiritual breakthroughs, right? Because you hit your kind of spiritual rock bottom, so to speak. And you're just like you're asking all the big questions. Why is this happening to me? What am I supposed to do at this moment? Type of thing. Mm-hmm. And then finally, in a number of our Christian episodes, there's a moment doctrinally that was really kind of big for these guests in different ways, either whether it be a change in theology. I think we heard that like three different times from people who had grown up Protestant, where their church just started getting into some theological ideas that they just couldn't, you know, stomach, or just the idea of, let's just say, institutional rupture, right? It's, you know, and you already mentioned some of the things that the Catholic Church has been going through lately. One of the things I think was kind of interesting from me coming at this from a Catholic point of view is hearing from these different traditions about things that I don't think Catholicism really prepares us well for. And the thing, and I mentioned this at the end of the Shinto episode, so this kind of comes to mind right now. Catholicism is very good at, you know, giving you a moral structure, right? Catholicism has something to say about pretty much any moral activity that you could partake in, and how to form it for good, how to create good habits and whatnot, you know, virtue. But I don't think it helps you go on a hike well. Catholicism has nothing to say about what a good hike looks like, I think. But a religion like Shinto has a lot to say about I think, what a good hike would look like, because of its respect for nature and finding the divine in nature. So, you know, so fluidly and abundantly. And I just wondered if there are other moments in the season that you can think of that maybe point to us what different traditions tell us about how to live well, that maybe Christianity just, it's not that it doesn't have anything to say, but maybe that's not the focus.
Yeah. Well, once again, this is us about having that deepening awareness of the incarnation, right? I mean, I think that one thing that we really realized in talking to some of these guests is that there was a strong emphasis on mind, body, spirit integration. And that's not something that we necessarily hear very often in Catholic circles, even though we should, because the Catholicism talks so much about the incarnation. And the incarnation is God becoming flesh. And flesh is everything. I mean, it's really our bodies are a very important role to this. I mean, even John Paul II recognized this in a very profound way with the theology of the body. And we need to affirm that as beings in this world, we are bodily beings, and that things within us and around us actually help us to understand who and whose we are in relationship to God. And I think that so many of these other people that we were able to interview here, they were able to be so at ease in looking at so many bodily types of movements and ways to use our bodies as profound moments of prayer. Now, we have moments of this in Catholicism, right? There's a lot of emphasis on bowing and genuflecting. But what about just our regular day-to-day activities like walking and running and just kind of picking things up and whatnot? Like, all those things have to have the same type of equal weight when it comes to being acts of prayer as if you were doing a profound bow or a genuflect, because in some ways those are all things that have us touch other things that we encounter, and that's affirming an interconnectivity of everything, which is affirming the reality of the Trinity and everything. I mean, so it makes sense for us to be able to take from other perspectives what we can understand is incarnational theology. I'll just keep on going back to that, because that's just the fundamental thing here that we're talking about here, is that everything that we've spoken to with people just deepens our awareness of the incarnation, God made flesh. It does nothing to threaten it or challenge it or be some type of parallel type of track to it. So mind, body, spirit integration, I think that's just been so awesome to see in so many different perspectives as we interviewed people this season.
Yeah. I think the Taoists maybe told us that the best, but that definitely was a theme throughout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From Islam, I think, you know, I was hearing just the radicality of the oneness of God. And we literally named the episode with Dahlia after that. Yeah, when you think about the incarnation, that's an interesting challenge, right? Because the incarnation forces us to hold the Trinity, and the oneness of God, the unity, forces us to recognize something that is just really hard to, I think, wrap your mind around. And maybe that's the point. Maybe we're not supposed to wrap any minds around anything, right? We, last night when we were talking, it was, you know, you were saying, I think we overcomplicate this all the time, right? And I think maybe that's because we approach things through our minds rather than through our bodies or just our lived experiences. You know, maybe the Trinity is less to be understood and more to be experienced.
Easier
absolutely. Said than done, obviously.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, we're experiencing it all the time, right? I mean, we are relational. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're only here existing because of the result of a relationship of our parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are just fundamentally relational. So how it's all held together in a great web of interconnectivity emphasizes the oneness, right? So it's always the as they always say, the problem of the one and the many. I mean, it's reconciled in just us understanding the Christian mystery, or at least, you know, trying to pierce the Christian mystery. But there is something about oneness in a certain type of dynamism that exists within relationality, which all of us are constantly in its participation with. So, I mean, you just can't escape it. We just can't. So I think that everything, once again, that we discussed this season was just kind of affirming our humanity. And we're able to do that from different types of religious traditions that have attempted to try to define it. And I think that, you know, we were talking at the very beginning of this about, like, you know, how do we define religion? Well, I think it's just hard to do because you know, it could be anything from an ideology to just the ritual types of practices, right? So, I mean, like, that's a really broad spectrum of things going on. But I do think that religion, maybe in the best sense, is a way to try to bring an awareness to the importance of life. Like, I think that that's kind of maybe what religion in its best sense is. It's an awareness to the importance of life and a life well lived.
I like that.
So I think that that's kind of why, when we're talking about religion to reality as a theme for this whole podcast, it is that the thing that, you know, to be real in the world is to be fully yourself, showing up in the world. And religion, in a certain sense, reminds you that that's the task at hand. And therefore, since it's a reminder, it doesn't necessarily make it necessary because it is what it is in how we live our life. But as human beings, I mean, we can also just kind of get caught up in things that take us away from reality. And
right.
Religion points us back to it.
Speaking of religion to reality and reminders, would you remind our listeners, and maybe they never knew, I think it's revealed one time in this season finally. By the way, this is our 50th episode. Do you know that? And if you
wow.
include the webinar series, it's 56.
Wow.
Like, this we have a lot of episodes.
We've been doing a lot here. Wow.
And we never talked about where the name came from. So do you want to tell our listeners? I think you casually mention it in one of our episodes, but not fully. So just tell our listeners how we got Religion to Reality as our name.
Yeah, it's from Alexander Schaumann's book, For the Life of the World. He was a Orthodox theologian and priest in the 20th century, and very popular during the time, I would say, of the Second Vatican Council. Thomas Merton was a really great proponent, I think, of Schaumann's work. And he really pierced at the very heart of the matter when he was really identifying the crisis in modernity in the context of what was happening in the mid 20th century. And he was basically saying that, you know, the way that we have treated, say, the church or religion, we've kind of created more of it as an end rather than a means for producing what it's supposed to produce, so to speak, which is an awareness of our relationship with God, that it became something that was too much thought to be something that stands alone and is practically devoid of understanding who God is, ironically, because it became so kind of inwardly focused. So he writes to us in For the Life of the World, a really big section here. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to quote much of this here because this is such a great section here, you know. So here, this I'll just read this part here. Before Christ came, God had promised him to man. He had done so in major fashion, speaking to the prophets of Israel, but also in those many other ways in which he communicates with man. As Christians, we believe that he who is the truth about both God and man gives foretastes of his incarnation in all more fragmentary truths. We believe as well that Christ is present in any seeker after truth. Simone Weil has said that though a person may run as fast as he can away from Christ, if it is toward what he considers true, he runs in fact straight into the arms of Christ. Much that is true of God has also been revealed in the long history of religion. And this can be demonstrated for the Christian by reference to the true standard of Christ. In the great religions, which have given shape to human aspirations, God plays on an orchestra which is far out of tune. Yet there has often been a marvelous, rich music made. God plays on an orchestra which is far out of tune. Yet there's often been a marvelous, rich music made. And then he goes on to say, Christianity, however, is in a profound sense the end of all religion. In the gospel story of the Samaritan woman at the well, Jesus made this clear. Sir, the woman said to him, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where man ought to worship. Jesus said unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when ye shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. But the hour cometh and now is when true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. She asked him a question about cult, and in reply, Jesus changed the whole perspective of the matter. Nowhere in the New Testament, in fact, is Christianity presented as a cult or as a religion. Religion is needed where there is a wall of separation between God and man. But Christ, who is both God and man, has broken down the wall between man and God. He has inaugurated a new life, not a new religion. I think there's a lot you can pull from there, right? There's so much more to say from this. It's a very small little book, but I think that that kind of gets to the heart of the matter here, that there's something here about religion that we use as a way to kind of remind us who we are. But the thing is, though, it's kind of not needed when we're able to just live who we are. And that's what the Christian is called to do by being in communion with Christ, which he or she is already in.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for reading that. Thanks for that extended quote. I want to transition now to talk about like the craft of actually making this podcast, what it was like for each of us. And maybe we can start with what was the most frustrating
let me count the ways.
Probably me for you. I mean, so like one of the things that that was clear to us, I don't think we ever said this to each other outright, but we didn't want this to be an exercise in academia, right? We wanted to talk to people who are really living out their tradition, talk about how they live it. And there were a couple of times when we were talking to someone who I felt like it was pulling teeth trying to get them to talk about their own spirituality. You know, like, I want to talk about you. We started every episode with a hint toward this, right? Because like, let's hear your story. But still it was difficult to, and I don't know if they're just uncomfortable talking about their practice. They don't have a practice. You know, so I don't know what it was, but there were some people that just wouldn't go there. And I was like, come on, man. Like that's what we came here for.
Well, I mean, it's understandable. I mean, I think that, we are trained in ways to look at our head as being a function of our entire person. And so what we're able to learn and know becomes foundationally important for us to then impart to other people. I mean, I think teachers and academics know this, that if they've discovered something, so to speak, or if they have a way of articulating something, they're going to double down on that at every chance they can, because that's a certain type of gift that they can give to the world. Mm-hmm. I think that what ends up happening in the process is that when we stay in our head too much, it's hard for us to kind of reveal more of our heart. So I think that that just kind of is the, I don't know, it's maybe the cost of allowing our head to kind of get the best of us. But it's understandable, though. I mean, because, you know, learning things is a very prized thing, and we all have to learn things, and we all should learn things. I mean, but I think that we can have a certain type of security and just kind of staying in our head and just kind of talking things that way as a way to kind of almost give credibility.
Because, or not just staying in the head, but like being impersonal, right? So speaking generically about my faith tradition rather than me, you know, specifically.
I mean, I think that there's probably always this type of conflict with going on where when we know certain things, but we know that we fall short of those things as just a person, that provides us, that always presents this type of conflict. And maybe we're just not happy with that conflict. Maybe we wish we could be more integrated and we're not. Maybe just because I know what foods I should eat to make me healthy doesn't mean I'm going to be eating them. And I can keep on talking about, oh, I have to eat these foods, but like that doesn't mean I'm doing it.
Yeah, I would say for me that was the most challenging part of this season for me, is just realizing that like there's all these great recommendations or things that I would love to do. I don't think I want to go on a year-long retreat, but I think I would love to do that 10-day retreat that we heard about, the silent retreat in the Buddhist tradition. But that's not a real that's not a possibility for me right now. I have a 1.5-year-old, who, by the way, you probably heard some of the intros to some of these episodes throughout the season. Sorry for that. But yeah, and yes, that's a real limitation. It would be like truly, it would be very inappropriate for me to tell my wife, yeah, I'm gonna be gone for 10 days because I need this spiritually. But there are other things that I probably am not letting myself start to do, even though I could very well do it. And we create these excuses for ourselves. So I think that's a challenge that probably everyone has to overcome, right? The momentum or lack thereof of just, whatever you are currently doing.
Absolutely.
Another thing that was sometimes challenging is just trying to be a really good listener. As a host, you're always thinking about what's the next thing you want to ask. But but as a listener, you want to not be thinking about what's the next thing you're going to ask. And we're trying to exemplify good listening because we're talking all about it, while, hosting a show, which is just a little bit different than having a regular conversation. So that was a challenge. But there were times when, as trying to be, a good listener, I didn't want to step on people's toes all the time and constantly interject. But one of our guests used the phrase, "You gotta obey your thirst," and that was like a Sprite tagline from the 90s or 2000s,
Oh
for my
yeah, I
childhood.
remember
And it was
that. Yeah.
all I could do to bring up that commercial. And obviously, it's a good thing I didn't. But that's just like a silly example of like these times where you want to say something, but someone's on a roll, and that would be inappropriate. Do you have any of that? Like, where you're just like, you've got lots of thoughts and you just kind of got to sit on it.
Lots of thoughts, and I sit on it. I'm just not understanding the question.
I just mean like, in the course of conversation, like you have things that, that you have,
Oh, I see what you
you
mean.
want to share, but out of respect, you don't.
I guess there's times like that. I think I'm getting a little bit more used to just letting someone else drive the conversation and just let it go where it goes. I mean,
Yeah, that's pretty
I think
clear in
it's
this
a little
episode.
bit. I don't like to kind of plan things too much anymore. I used to be a big planner. I don't know how much I do that anymore, but.
I won't go into our personal relationship. So so listening without agenda, like this is the thing that, kind of inspired the season. It's the question that we asked every guest at the end of the episode, right? How do you listen without agenda? And two of our guests challenged us on that premise. Everyone had a good answer for how do you listen, but AJ Levine and Lauren Pfister both said, I don't know that you can listen without agenda, that everyone comes in with something, and I think that's right. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, that was good. I do agree. I think it's hard not to have an agenda, because even if your agenda is not to have an agenda, that is an agenda. So I mean, I think that we do bring too much of ourselves to the whole listening. But I think the way that we were trying to say it is like, what can you do to detach yourself from your agenda? So I think it's being aware that you have one all the time. And how do you kind of keep that in perspective as you're listening?
Right.
So it requires a certain type of proactivity. So when we talk about proactively listening, I don't think it just means like, oh, I'm just really have my eyes really wide open and I'm just like looking right at you. I mean, yeah, that's part of it. But it's the proactive part is more like constantly just trying to keep your own thoughts, your own opinions, your own agenda, just somewhat in the background so you can be more open to just listening. Because, you know, we all just do. I mean, it's impossible to kind of rid ourselves of our experience of life, and especially of different ways that we've been hurt and wounded. I mean, if we've been hurt and wounded a certain way, we don't want to experience that again, and we don't want other people to experience that type of hurt and woundedness. So if we hear something that we think is hurtful and can lead to wounds, we're going to quickly put up a big wall against it. So then the challenge becomes like, how could it possibly be that the person who's saying what they're saying is speaking from their types of wounds and hurts? So maybe the common thread here of us understanding how to listen is to have the fundamental recognition that we've all been hurt and wounded in different ways. And what we say and how we say it and what we espouse is our way of navigating through those wounds and hurts. So can we listen to a person's hurts and wounds through what they're saying? Because that to me is getting into the heart of the matter of the person.
It's really deep. Right. It's almost like applying the medium as the message in a different way, right?
Mm.
But it almost doesn't matter what they're saying. It's like, what are they really trying to communicate here? That's great. I want to come back to something that you said. I can't remember if it might have been in season one, where you talked about the topic of astrology came up, and you talked about how, like, even when people dabble in something like astrology, that let's say is not compatible with our understanding of Christianity, that you don't see the harm because it shows that they're seeking to engage the mystery of life in some way. I'm probably adding a little bit to what you said, but I'm trying to paraphrase here. And I agree that this can be a healthy sign of something. And I don't want to get into whether it's right or wrong, but what I'm curious about is, like, how do you hold that? How do you genuinely appreciate that someone is earnestly seeking something, even while you completely disagree with them on the facts or whether the thing is even real, without that appreciation belying the fact that you think that they're wrong?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess it's hard for me to answer the question because I think it's so caught up in the moment of knowing who's talking to you. I mean, it's not so much about like just creating a general way of dealing with that. I think, but it's hard for me to not say it from what I just kind of said before. I think you have to be able to recognize that each person is extremely wounded. Like we all are. But I think the only way you can do that is if you really understand your own wounds. And maybe a lot of people haven't gone there, or they're just completely just thinking that they don't have it nearly as bad as other people, which is another way of not really dealing with your wounds when you say things like that. Or when you just don't think you have it, that you have any. I mean, that's just avoidance, I guess. But if you're really getting at the heart of maybe your own woundedness and hurts, knowing that, you know, things have been done to you that should not have been done to you, and because of that, it makes you act a certain way, and you're on a certain type of defensive mechanism that you kind of play, and you have coping mechanisms and other types of things that you kind of lean into. Like, I think when you do that inner work with yourself, I think you have a far better chance of being able to be okay with someone just spouting out stuff that you think is just horrible, because you're just hearing a wounded person. You're not hearing what they're saying,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's a different thing that you're hearing.
Not because you recognize the same wounds, but because just the woundedness itself is something you're more familiar with and can be empathetic toward and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and I think that always has to then go to, like, I wonder why this person feels so passionate about what they're saying, which I fundamentally disagree with. Like, asking that question of why, which you won't have an answer for unless you somehow keep on, you know, peeling away at the onion with that person. But because you don't know, I think can make you a little bit less prone to just jump on that person right away and kind of like, you know, either feel the need to correct or to judge or something.
One of the things I wanted to reflect on is my own insecurities about religion that I have had for forever, basically. You know, as a cradle Catholic, I've always been really, I'm trying to decide how the best way to say this. I always felt like I probably seem like some kind of fraud to, let's say, to like a non-Christian or even to a non-Catholic, because an outside person looking at my life, you know, even if I had explored other traditions, and I have to certain extents, not as extensively certainly as my own, would say, well, so you're telling me you just happen to be born into the true one, you know, like you're still the religion that you grew up with. And so you're telling me you just got lucky enough to, like, you know, be born the right one that you should still be. And I always had like this kind of chip on my shoulder about that. And projects like this have really helped me to stop thinking like that, because, because I, you know, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier about like just the idea of even having the delineation of like, I am letting my identity be about, you know, the name that I call my tradition. That's, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but I don't feel the need to rep that in such a strong way anymore, where like, I think it a little bit is about recognizing what religion is for, like what healthy religion does, which is to, you know, hopefully transform you. And if it's a religion that involves God, to be starting to be divinized in the Lord, you know, like that's what it's about. It's not about like being right about stuff. It's not about being like happy, you know, just going on in the world, being correct about, you know, how things work. And so that movement from the head to the heart, I think, is what is allowing me to like stop being concerned about, you know, I mean, first of all, there's a maturity in just not caring what people think. That there's that too, but it's more than that, because it's about me too. Like I wonder for myself, like, does it make sense? Like, did I really just get lucky? No, it's not. And maybe it's not about that. It's like, well, what is Christianity doing for me that I wouldn't have without it? And, you know, and as we have, I think, illustrated deeply in this season, it's great. It's not just okay. It's great to draw other truths and practices and so forth from other traditions that may also help you along this thing we call the spiritual journey. And that's all good. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't need to have a name necessarily. A lot of guests were pretty reticent to talk about like what they call themselves, and I actually like that, because that's not the important thing,
right? Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I can relate to that on a certain level as a priest. I mean, like, I don't like to always lead with that identity or that part of me when I'm talking to someone, because it just kind of skews everything a certain way. It's like, and I just don't know how helpful that is at times. Sometimes it's very helpful. I get that, but it's not always helpful. And it's not helpful for me personally, because that means like I can't really get to the heart of who this person is, because I feel like some type of now performative thing is now happening because they know who I am, you know? So I think whenever we can kind of detach ourselves from these identities that we somehow find ourselves in or that we subscribe to, it's helpful, because it just kind of, you know, it declutters the filtration process, I think, in some ways, that could happen when we're always trying to look things through our particular lens, or how we look through the lens of someone else who identifies by a particular way. So I think that, once again, I guess a holistic mind, body, spirit type of way of understanding things makes you realize that, you know, you never want to really hold to any one part of your identity too hard, because it somehow doesn't necessarily always permeate all other parts of our person, which is really what it should do, but it sometimes it doesn't. I mean, most Catholics who are very devout, I feel, are always constantly feeling like they're living in two worlds all the time. Like there's the religious world and the secular world, the sacred and the profane, or however you want to say it. And that there's always this kind of like sizing everything up into like how Catholic something is in relationship to basically how non-Catholic it is. And there's always that type of stuff going on. And I don't think that's helpful. I mean, it's helpful when you're trying to understand just maybe who you are and trying to get a way to navigate through a very complex world that we live in. I get that. But there has to come to a point where you're just not constantly always just trying to size things up based on your own identity to a religious identity. When you're understanding yourself as a beloved child of God, then everyone's beloved as well. So there is no difference at that point. And that's the, like Martin Luther King would talk about, the beloved community, like the beloved community. I mean, that to me gets to that point of it's like, well, now we're all just humans. We're not Catholics and Protestants and Muslims and Hindus, you know?
Yeah, right. When we talk about seeing Christ in the other, in every other, then it's not about projecting Christianity onto them. That has nothing to do with it. It's you know, what you've said before. It's that incarnational worldview. Well, do you have any final thoughts, John, you know, just on this season as we wrap up?
Yeah, first, I just wanted to thank you, Dave, for bringing me on this project with you, because it was just so enlightening in so many different ways and so helpful for me. And this season's particularly made me realize there's so much more for me to learn, right? I mean, by hearing from so many different perspectives, there's so much for me to learn. There's so much more ways I can grow. This whole incarnational theology, spirituality, that's a real thing. And this is just pushing me beyond that. And also, I think just recognizing that there's a lot of similarities with things too, with people from different walks of life. Because, you know, we're all human, and to affirm our humanity is to affirm our divinity. That's incarnational theology 101, right? To affirm our humanity is to affirm our divinity. And I think that, you know, since we all suffer, since we all realize we are part of a complex world with challenges, that each of us are doing the best we can. And whatever gifts we've been given to be able to try to make sense and navigate through this world from different, say, religious traditions, they're gifts that are meant for everyone. And I think that we were able to kind of maybe embrace some of those gifts a little bit by these different conversations and learn from them. And like I said, push us further on our own journey.
Absolutely. Well, if you've listened to every episode, you've heard me say this a lot, but I'm just going to say it one more time. Religion to Reality is not just a podcast. Religion to Reality is also we have a website. You can go to the website to check out things like the show notes and guest bios and all that good stuff, religiontoreality.org. We also have a Substack now, and we did that in order for me to continue to blog about this project even after all the episodes are released. So I'll continue to be putting thoughts out there at religiontoreality.substack.com. And that's also the place where you can sign up for our interfaith monthly gathering. It's a free online gathering that happens on the first Wednesday of the month at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Each meeting focuses on a particular topic, like compassion or gratitude, and we talk about that topic. We meditate. We have time for meditation. We have time for sharing in terms of, you know, what we're struggling with, what we're thankful for. And the point is to just come together with people from different walks of life, different traditions that may be different from your own. And the great thing is, not only are John and I there, but we also have some of our guests joining already. So I'd love to have you there. You know, as we record this, it's July 2026, and I'm hopeful that it will be going for a long time. So whenever you hear this, check out the Substack, follow for free, and see if you can sign up for the next monthly gathering. I want to give an extended credit roll today because there are just so many people to thank and give credit to. And this isn't just our season finale. This is the series finale. This is the end of Religion to Reality. And maybe I should have made that clear before, but unfortunately, and you know, look, I'm not sad about it, but this is the end. So here we go. First of all, huge props and thank you to our season one and guest episodes, for the most part, producer Connor Donnelly, and our season two and webinar series producer, Nick Stropoli, who pumped out over 25 episodes in like a month. So thank you, Nick. That was huge.
Yes. Thank you, Nick. Amazing.
Also, thanks to Dominic Ambrosio and Len Camporeo for helping develop the show early on as we were just coming up with what we wanted to do and how we're going to do it. I want to give a shout out to the marketing team at DeSales Media, especially Israel Ochoa, a designer extraordinaire who created the visual language and branding and the design execution of every graphic Religion to Reality has ever had. So thank you to Israel. Christina Valente, marketing specialist and the powerhouse behind the team who published every episode, the show notes, the transcripts, the keywords, and every piece of social content we've ever had. Huge thanks to Christina. Johnny Ayad, digital marketing and development guru who built the website, made sure that every episode got posted on it. So huge thanks to Johnny. And I just want to give a shout out to the rest of the marketing team. JT Beisel, our marketing manager, Dami Chakravarti, our senior graphic designer, Richard Cordero, our graphic designer, and Joe Lentine, our social community manager. It's been an honor working with all of you. What a great team. I also want to give special thanks to Bill Mayer, my mentor and very close friend of John and mine, for greenlighting the discipleship study that kickstarted this whole project way back when, and for his ongoing support and guidance. I want to give thanks to my wife, Susie, for always believing in us and in the meaning of this work, and for keeping my 1.5-year-old quiet during every recording session. I want to give a shout out to my friend, Danielle, who keeps listening even though her husband... So she likes to fall asleep to podcasts, and she does this, like, it's...
Saying a lot about this podcast, but
right. Yeah, she tells me, she's like, yeah, I always listen to it again on the train on the next day because, like, you know, I fall asleep. But her husband's put a stop to it. He's like, honey, when I wake up at 3 a.m., I'm okay with you, like, still having a podcast going, but I don't want Dave's voice in the room right now. Like, I don't need to wake up to the sound of Dave in my room. So other podcasts, please. But yeah, so shout out to DIDL for being a diehard listener. And to all of our guests over the years, there's too many to mention right now, but, you know, huge thanks. Obviously, we couldn't do this without you. And we also couldn't do this without you, our listeners. So if you're somehow still here and listening to this, you've made this labor of love worthwhile for us, and I really appreciate you. I wish you peace and every good.
Thank you. Goodbye.